540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, the submersible that disappeared during a Titanic dive is found in pieces. U.S. Coast Guard Rear Admiral John Mauger.
The debris is consistent with the catastrophic loss of the pressure chamber.
CBS's Roxana Saberi.
The cause of the implosion is still unknown, but all five people aboard were killed. OceanGate founder Stockton Rush, billionaire adventurer Hamish Harding, Pakistani businessman Shahzadeh Dawood, and his 19-year-old son Suleiman, and French explorer Paul-Henri Narjolet. The Titan has been missing since Sunday, when it descended to the Titanic wreckage site about 2.5 miles beneath the North Atlantic.
The National Weather Service confirms a tornado touched down today in Highlands Ranch, south of Denver. KCNC-TV's Connor McHugh.
There's just trees that are completely ripped out at the roots. There's others that were just kind of cut right halfway through the trunk. So it was incredibly strong coming through here.
At least four people died in a tornado last night in the small town of Matador, Texas. Mayor Pat Smith.
It's devastating for the whole community. I mean, we need prayers for lots of people lost their homes.
Oregon's most populated county says climate change is costing taxpayers money, and it's suing. KXL's John Eric Smith in Portland.
The lawsuit names ExxonMobil, Shell, ConocoPhillips, many more, claiming their petroleum products are causing deadly heat waves. Attorney Roger Worthington says the county is looking for compensation for the money it spent running cooling shelters, providing meals, and distributing air conditioners to high-risk residents.
With the costs we're paying, the costs we're going to have to pay, the money they're raking in, who pays? How about the people who caused it? How about sticking them with the bill? Yeah. That's what we do.
In all, the county is seeking over $50 billion.
A judge blocks an abortion pill ban in Wyoming just before it was set to take effect. CBS's Stacey Lynn.
Abortion pills will remain legal in Wyoming for now after a judge ruled that the state's first-in-the-nation law to ban them won't take effect July 1st as planned while a lawsuit proceeds. While other states have instituted de facto bans on the medication by broadly prohibiting abortion, in March, Wyoming became the first U.S. state to specifically ban abortion pills.
CBS's Deputy Director of Surveys, Jennifer DePinto, with a finding from CBS's latest poll on abortion and the upcoming election 1 year after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade.
45% of Democrats say what they've seen over the past year regarding abortion makes them more likely to vote in the presidential election next year, compared to just 29% of Republicans who say that.
France's Victor Wembanyama is selected by the San Antonio Spurs with the first pick of the NBA draft. This is CBS News.
Need hires who dazzle without the hassle? You need Indeed. Their powerful platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Here's what you need to know in southeast Wisconsin. We're working on learning more about what's called a tactical situation in Elkhorn today. People in a neighborhood near West Court Street and West Street were told to shelter in place. Currently on medical leave as the superintendent of Racine Unified Schools, Eric Gallion will soon transition to become the superintendent of a school in South Carolina. As Gallion prepares to relocate across the country, Racine Unified is expected to announce an interim superintendent in the coming week. How not to lose a finger is a goal of a Racine County event this weekend. Pete Schwaba has more.
Keeping it safe with a chainsaw is the subject of a River Bend Nature Center event this weekend. An instructor from Gateway leads the presentation that covers basic rules, cutting techniques, and safety equipment such as chaps. The event Saturday morning is free.
For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today, 855-954-1186.
All in two wins, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTW Law.
It's time you checked out Champion's Pub on Milwaukee's East Side, a classic Milwaukee tavern since 1956. Champion's is a comfortable place to gather and enjoy a drink over a game of shuffleboard, cribbage, bags, golden tea, or just relax in its sunny beer garden or covered deck. Champion's Pub has something for everyone. It's a great place to escape the usual bar crowds and hide out for drinks and conversation. Stop by Champion's Pub and enjoy its good service and low-key neighborhood atmosphere.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge, counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Shout out to the Democrats in Pennsylvania, who the House of Representatives passed an increase in the minimum wage. By 2026, going to get up to $15 an hour, going to raise that tipped minimum wage to 60% of the top rate. Also going to index it to inflation. Now, just going to have to get it through the Senate and on to Josh Shapiro's desk, which getting through the Senate is going to be the problem. And the thing that blows my mind is, you know, Pennsylvania still has one of the lowest minimum wages in the country, still at $7.15. Now, obviously, we have to go to the $7.25 of the federal minimum wage, but everyone else around us, higher minimum wage. Even West Virginia, we're pulling West Virginia down. Think about that for a second. Now, the reality is we got to raise wages. We got to get more into our economy. And how do we do that? I argue a big part of that is good policy at the federal level, good tax policy, and one of my favorite topics, taxing the rich. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we do some of that, I've asked my good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So good on Pennsylvania. I mean, at least the House has passed this minimum wage increase. Republicans kind of losing their mind. It's going to kill small business, Morris. It's going to kill millions. It's going to kill jobs. It's bad.
What I always say, Rick, you know, you walk into the bar on Friday night, the guy who owns the bar, he cares a lot more about how much beer money all the people standing around and sitting in the booths have than he does about the wages of that one guy who's standing behind the bar pouring the beer. He needs customers who make more money. Talk to the people in Seattle who are complaining that they have to close their businesses. What do they have to do? They have to pay more rent because they had to get bigger spaces because everyone eats out more since they raised the minimum wage there.
Yeah.
It's a helpful thing for the economy, for business people. You know, they complain, oh, there's no more low-wage jobs in Seattle. It's not because the workers got fired. It's because they got raises. They aren't low-wage workers anymore because they got raises when the minimum wage went up. Things do well with higher wages. If I'm opening a business, I want to open that business in a place where people make enough money to pay for stuff,
yep,
not in a place with all poor people.
But how come we don't hear that enough? I mean, you know, my inbox was full of, you know, we're going to lose thousands of jobs. You know, one in four, restaurant workers are going to be out of a job because, you know, these poor small mom and pops aren't going to be able to pay this massive increase. And look, you know, $15 an hour, I don't know, is a massive increase. when you're looking at the cost of living going on. How, I don't even know how you make ends meet on 7.25, let alone you know, survive.
Well, you don't. Nobody can live. There's no place in the country where people can make a living and support a family on 7.25 an hour. You don't. The only people who do that are on public assistance, and that's not good either. I want a place where people make enough money to live on and go shopping and buy stuff and shop in the stores that I invest in and pay their iPhone bills every month and make their rent on the first of the month. That's how people like me make money. It trickles up from all the people paying all those little bills every month to investors like me who sit here and don't do anything except collect money when it comes in.
Now,
That's what we need.
Now, policy-wise, I look at the Republicans right now. There is a Republican study committee report that evidently has come out that, again, Republicans are going after entitlement programs. Again, we're going after Social Security, going after Medicare. We're going after all of those things. We're going to raise the Social Security age. We're going to do all of these things that are going to harm working people. I got to tell you, I think this is bad for the economy. It's bad for morale, and it's bad for the country, but yet they're still hell-bent on this is their way. This is their policy.
They honestly, I think they only know people who are like investors and business owners. And sure, it's great for me that I pay a much lower tax rate than people who work for a living and get a paycheck with tax deducted every single week. And yeah, that helps me get rich. But I don't need the money. I just get richer. I don't spend more money if I pay lower taxes than you do. What we need is for them to go after a little bit the people at the top, the people who pay much lower tax rates than working people because they get all their money from investments and things like that.
Yeah.
That's what we need, is to even things out a little bit and take a little bit of the burden off of the people who are working for a living and tell the people who are rich that they have to pay at least the same tax rates as workers do.
Now, this message should resonate. I know you guys, through your Great Economy Project, are out there on the ground, you know, trying to you know, educate people into this way of thinking. I mean, I know it's been a while since we've had an economy that's worked for working people, but, you know, getting out there and talking to people, what's been the experience like for you guys? And what have been the obstacles in getting past this narrative that, because, you know, my whole life we've been told, if we give you all the money, Morris, because you're smart, you're the smart guy in the room here, if we give you all the money, you know what to do with it, and you'll do the best thing because you're smart and the market will help you and all of that. How do we undo that narrative?
Well, sure, having lots of money is good for me. I'm all for it. I run a group called Patriotic Millionaires. We're in favor of people being millionaires. It's great. I recommend everybody become a millionaire.
I wish.
But in the meantime, I prefer living in a country with people who are able to make a living and support their families. I don't want to live in a country where, you know, poor people are riding in the streets because they're starving and have nothing else to do. That does not work for me. It does not work for my children, and now I have a grandchild. So we have to explain that to people. I think what it is we have to transcend parties. You know, you had Kat last week, and she's running the project in North Carolina, a little town about an hour's drive west of the, you know, beach resorts, an hour's drive east of the military base. And we got 50 some odd people together, and these people, they think that Trump is somewhere above God, but they're also willing to talk to their Republican state representatives and ask, why are you against the minimum wage? Why are you for tax breaks for rich people? Why can't we get a tax break? Why can't we get higher wages? So they're with us on the policies. And so what we're doing is we're going to talk about policies, and we're not going to talk about candidates or parties or any of that kind of stuff. We're just going to tell them about how these policies work. We gave them our lecture from the Tax the Rich book. We had other speakers come talk to them about how much more money, you know, business executives make than they do, about how much lower taxes business executives pay than they do, about how billionaires are getting away with murder, Donald Trump's words too. And now these people are talking to their state representatives about these policies. Are they going to vote differently? I don't know. But maybe their representatives in their state capital in Raleigh, North Carolina, are going to hear from them, and they're going to think a little bit differently.
Because it comes back down to, you know, again, you have this, the only thing I keep coming back to is, you know, John Steinbeck's The Embarrassed Millionaire. We're all going to be, as you said, we're all going to be millionaires. And we haven't gotten there yet, but someday we're going to get there. And so we don't want to make it worse. It seems ridiculous to me that working people would.
It's that they think they're going to be millionaires. These people know for a fact they're not going to be millionaires unless they happen to, you know, hit a lottery ticket, and they don't even have the money to buy lottery tickets, they have to get one that somebody drops. I think they've been told so much that, oh, you guys shouldn't be voting based on making more money or doing well for yourselves. You should vote based on a philosophy of everyone for himself, and government is bad, and nobody should help other people. And that's what they've been told their whole lives by people from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump. And we have to tell them, actually, no, this country was built by people who helped each other. They created states, they call them commonwealths. Like, you live in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania because they needed common wealth. A bunch of people put their wealth together to do things they couldn't do by themselves. And we have a word for that, and we call it government. Government is not a bad thing. It's just a word we use for people doing stuff together in an organized way, instead of each person having to find their own way to do everything.
Yeah.
Those of us who are rich know we depend on the government. We depend on property rights. We depend on police. We depend on all kinds of things. And we couldn't be rich without a government. And that has to be what everyone understands.
Well, that's an excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Morris Pearl. He's the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires. PatrioticMillionaires.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Jerry in Wisconsin asked the question, if you want higher taxes, why don't you just pay higher taxes instead of trying to impose them on us? Now, this is an interesting point, because this platforms Jerry, which I doubt Jerry's in the same economic ballpark that you are, but this idea that by raising taxes on people that you keep saying we need to raise taxes on the wealthy, that somehow it's going to be raised on Jerry as well. Can you talk to that kind of, you know, how we've trained a generation to, you know, to foam at the mouth like Pavlovian dogs anytime the idea of raising taxes comes up without even ever asking on whom we're talking?
Well, first of all, if Jerry happens to be a millionaire landlord who doesn't actually work, but makes money buying and selling apartment buildings in Wisconsin, well then, yeah, I think we should raise his taxes. If Jerry is somebody who works for a living, even as a doctor who makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and gets money deducted from his paycheck every single week, we think he should pay lower taxes, because he's getting ripped off by those other people who are paying less taxes than he is. And the reason I don't actually want to pay more taxes, but I want to live in a country where we have more of the things that I want, and I know that's necessary. You know, it's kind of like if I'm in a club and I want the dining room to be refurbished, and, you know, well, the meeting of our club members, and I can give a speech and I can talk about how nice it'll be to have a fancier dining room and, you know, better furniture. And maybe I'll win, and we'll change the club dues and have higher dues and refurbish the room. Or maybe I won't win. But if I lose, that doesn't mean I'm going to personally pay to have the dining room refurbished. It means that I lost the vote, and maybe we'll try again next year, but we're going to have lower, you know, dues and not refurbish the dining room. I can't do something by myself that's going to make a dent in inequality. I have to change the system in our country, And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
I'm using my money to pay our staff who's working on this. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to change the whole system to make the system more fair. I actually don't want to pay higher taxes myself. I hate paying taxes. But I want to live in a system that's more fair. And that's why I'm in favor of changing the rules so that all rich investors who don't work pay higher taxes.
So last question I've got for you, because again, it comes back down to who we're talking about. We're not talking about Jerry. Who knows? Jerry may, I hope he'll get back with me and tell me if he drives a truck or swings a hammer or whatever Jerry does for a living. We're not talking about your wage earner, you know, your ham and egger who's showing up at the factory. We're talking about raising taxes on people who are you know, in the areas that we don't generally see.
We're talking about raising taxes for people who don't work. If you're a person who works for a living and you get taxes deducted from your paycheck, you are paying a higher tax rate already.
Yeah.
We are saying that other people who don't work should pay the same tax rates that you are already paying. That's my message for Jerry and for the rest of your listeners.
There you go. And it's a good one. Hope folks will check out the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Morris, as always, good talking with you. I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Morris Pearl. Make sure you check out the website there, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Right back with your thoughts, 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, this is interesting. I'm sure you've heard me talk about the Maniac Moms for Liberty group. Evidently, they're having a big shindig in Philadelphia. And as part of their promotion, they got a big sign. The Parent Brigade. Is the title of it, Parent Advocacy Through Unifying, Educating, and Empowering. And as you're looking at the thing that they got there, this handout, there's a quote. There's a quote on it. And everyone likes to add quotes to their literature. And the quote is, "He alone who owns the youth gains the future." And you go, "Well, gee, who said that?" Adolf Hitler. The Maniac Moms for Liberty are literally quoting Hitler, and right underneath it, and this is what I loved about it, because look, am I surprised that fascists and these folks who are hyper militant and I think off the fringe, but am I surprised that they're quoting Hitler? No. But they underneath it, their message from their founders is Moms for Liberty will not be intimidated by hate groups. And that's what this one of Moms for Liberty will not be intimidated by hate groups. And you go, you're quoting Hitler. Now they have, in their defense, they have apologized. Evidently, and I'm going to make a joke here. Evidently, they didn't know who Hitler was. Didn't get that education. And this is my problem with a lot of the stuff that we see going on. You know, you've got these people who are their parents, and we give them all of this power, and you need a license to get a dog. Also, the big story of the day, for me anyway, evidently on Tuesday, a postal worker in Dallas died during his route because of the heat. And you go, well, why is this a big deal? This is a guy who worked for, you know, the Postal Service for 40 years. And the Texas heat is brutal. The governor there signed a law, the Death Star Bill. We've talked about it. That preempts all local legislative action. Basically gives the state complete control. So in Austin and Dallas, where they passed heat legislation to protect workers, this bill that Abbott signed, this Death Star bill, did away with that. There are some who are saying now that this guy, this Eugene Gates, 40-year employee of the Postal Service, could still be alive if not for that legislation. And you look at the cruelty of this. And I've always said Republicans do things, and the cruelty is the point. When these legislative bodies take these actions, they know what they're doing. They know when they're pursuing preemption bills on minimum wage or sick days or heat restrictions. They know exactly what they're doing. The lobby groups have told them exactly what they're doing. The think tanks have laid out exactly what they want. This is the thing I think most Americans don't understand. And this is frightening, because it's been built up around us. You know, when you hear all of these euphemistic names of these groups, like Moms for Liberty, you think, oh, these are just a bunch of grassroots moms who just love their children. They just care. No, that's not who this is. This is big money. These are massively well-funded organizations who have an agenda, and you don't get to know the agenda. And they do. They pull in people thinking, oh, well, we're just defending parental rights, when the goal really is about destroying public education. It's about dominance. It's about grooming our children the way they deem acceptable. The same thing on policy. You look at all of these think tanks that have popped up. Every state has a conservative think tank, the State Policy Network. You have this huge umbrella, you know, the ALEC, the Heritage Foundations, the American Enterprise Institute, all of these right-wing business conservative kind of think tanks. And it all filters down to the state levels, and then to the county levels, and then to your local level. They have figured out how to infiltrate every level of our government with their poison. And that's why I say all the time, focus group tested, think tank approved. They pay people lots of money to come up with bad ideas to harm working people. And they spend lots of money focus group testing things so that the messaging for the poison that you're taking, it goes down a little better. They know what flavor Kool-Aid you're going to like to put the poison in. And this is where I keep saying we have got to get smarter quicker, because this isn't new. It's not news. They've been doing this for decades. It's that they've perfected it, and now they've got these astroturf groups that they fund with huge amounts of money, who are pushing this kind of this latest kind of poison. So when a worker dies on the job, well, you know, that's sad. No, it was predictable. It was part of the policy that the government of Texas decided they were going to pursue, because there were protections in place. And every worker who loses their life because of a lack of protection in this country I blame on the Republican Party, because they are the ones who are deregulating at every opportunity. They are the ones who have been destroying workers' rights for decades in this country. So when people die, it's not just a tragedy. It should be a crime. And again, I come back to the cruelty is the point. They do this knowing what they're going to do. They know what the outcomes are going to be, and they don't care. They don't care about you. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Quick break, right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that the Cuyahoga River, which winds its way through Cleveland, Ohio, caught on fire. Cleveland was once the sixth largest city in the nation. During the early 20th century, the city had a booming steel industry. Clevelander John D. Rockefeller made the city a leader in oil refining. But after World War II, industries left strong Union cities like Cleveland and Detroit. These jobs moved south and overseas, where wealthy industrialists could exploit workers in markets with weak labor protections. As a result, Cleveland fell on hard times. During the 1960s, the city lost 150,000 residents. As jobs left town, so did the workers. The once proud factories that lined the banks of the Cuyahoga River had brought jobs to the city, but they also pumped pollution into the waterway. When a passing train put off sparks, the river oozing with oil and debris caught fire. It was not the first time that the river ignited. Time magazine posted dramatic photos of the burning river, although the photos were actually from an earlier blaze. The pictures helped to fuel the growing environmental movement. They gave momentum to the passage of the Clean Water Act. The Cuyahoga was not the only urban river impacted by industry. The Time article described how, quote, Omaha's meat packers filled the Missouri River with animal grease balls as big as oranges. Today, one of Cleveland's breweries sells a popular Burning River pale ale. The Burning River is part of the history and the folklore of the city.
The known big river, the known. Burn on, big river.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Years ago, a Texas lawmaker got caught using his official position to enrich himself by taking money from special interests in exchange for voting their way. The culprit did not deem this as corrupt, but just the normal ethic of an enterprising business transaction. I seen my chances, he explained, and I took them. This is the Clarence Thomas Code of Ethics. As has been widely reported, this Supreme Court judge, who reliably rules for corporate supremacy over the people's interests, has secretly been on the take for years from a billionaire corporate right-winger. Real estate tycoon Harlan Crow, an extremist activist for plutocratic government, has been lavishing millions of dollars worth of luxury vacations, private jet travel, family housing and educational payments, and other gratuities on Thomas. Yet, this supposedly supreme lawyer says he detected no whiff of bribery, nor did he see any need to inform us commoners of it. He simply seen his chances and took 'em. But Thomas knew damn well that it was improper, corrupting, and disgusting. After all, during the last 3 decades, he has consistently voted for court rulings to make such obvious graft legal. For example, he's voted again and again to drain common sense from our anti-corruption laws, declaring that it is legal for a corporation to keep a public official on private retainer, that it's okay for political officials to sell access to their offices, that the appearance of corruption is not corrupt. And directly relevant to Harlan Crow, Thomas voted that it is technically not bribery to try influencing public officials by bestowing a series of gifts to them over time. This is Jim Hightower saying, if it seems to you like the system is rigged to favor the powerful, there you have it. Clarence Thomas is both the rigger and the beneficiary of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember back in October, November last year, we were in Erie, Pennsylvania, and did a show on our Working Class Heroes radio tour from the UE local there in Erie. And one of the things we were talking about back then is, you know, the upcoming contract talks, what potentially could happen. And there was, you know, some concern that potentially there would be a strike. Well, I'm going to report that in this hour, the UE locals of 506 and 618 have gone on strike at Wabtec Locomotive at the plant there in Lawrence Park. Our thoughts are with them, and that's why I've asked the UE General President, Carl Rosen, to come talk with us. Carl, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, thanks for having us here. It's always a pleasure, Rick, and especially when we've got news to spread.
So what's going on? What got us here?
Well, what got us here basically is a new company taking over this very old plant, part of America's industrial heartland, where many of the probably majority of the locomotives on the roads, on the railroads in the U.S. were produced here over the years. And a new company took it over 4 years ago, and the workers here, represented by UE Locals 506 and 618, have just felt totally disrespected for the last 4 years. Grievances that they used to be able to get settled, couldn't get settled. Company basically running roughshod over folks. And even when we took cases to arbitration and won, the company would then appeal it into the federal courts just to tie it up, delay. 4 years of justice, delayed, justice denied. And the workers had some fairly straightforward demands on how to fix that, core one of which being the right to strike over grievances, which they historically had under GE when they were the owner for 80 plus years, which helped level the playing field a little bit, ensured some accountability, and made sure that the managers were willing to actually figure out how to work out issues. And it was a right that was very, very rarely exercised, but the fact that it was there in the background was enough to keep both sides honest.
Yeah.
Because the union wasn't going to, march a couple thousand workers out the door and lose pay over something meaningless either. It had to be serious. But, so that's a big issue. Additional big issues is when the company came in, they imposed a new system where it takes 10 years for new hires to get up to the full rate of the job. That's too long. It takes too long to move through it. They're not even able to hire people at the rates that they have. So we needed improvement there. We wanted our health care protected. They came in demanding that we switch over to a plan where we've got no protections on increases in premiums, in co-pays. There's increased out-of-pocket costs, tremendous increases in some cases for things like hearing aids, for example. That was totally unacceptable. And then at the core of this is what's the future here? They need to be producing what we call green locomotives. I think we've talked about this on your show before, that are needed to help stop climate change, increase the livability for workers and communities around rail yards, where right now diesel fumes are being belched out. The railroads need to be forced to replace them with modern locomotives. Those modern locomotives, we're looking for a commitment that they get built here in Erie. They weren't willing to make a commitment in writing on that either, or even on working with us to push the railroads to do this. And so, there's just been steady non-cooperation here on getting to a reasonable settlement. The contract expiration day came. We actually negotiated another day beyond that to see if we could get it done. Instead, what we got is late on the evening into the evening of the day that the contract was expiring, they delivered us a notice that they were looking at farming out, contracting out 275 of our jobs, eliminating those jobs from the plant on a permanent basis.
Wow. So that was really a slap in the face. And I would argue that was probably to kind of force you into this, because I don't know how you take that and not end up on the picket line.
Well, what they thought was that they were able to blackmail us into accepting a contract under. And instead, you know, we negotiated the next day, tried to get them to back off, and they agreed that they that if we accepted their terms, they wouldn't do that layoff. I mean, it clearly was a threat to get their way on this. They ended up putting what they called a last, best, and final on the table the following day. We told them we didn't think it would be acceptable. This was probably about 10 days ago at this point. We tried every day since then to get them to improve that. They made some noises at times that maybe they would, but then when it finally came down to it, we finally got a final copy of the document out of them just 2 days ago, it had no improvements in it essentially whatsoever. Executive board studied it. And the executive board had the authority to take folks out on strike if needed, but they felt that with all of these different parts, moving parts in it and the threat to the jobs and all, they wanted the members to speak. As they put it, you know, 1,400 members speaking is a much louder voice than 17 members of the e-board saying it.
Correct.
And so they scheduled a membership vote for today. They looked at the final version of the document with none of the needed improvements in it on Tuesday. And voted to recommend to the membership to reject the contract, which would mean immediately going on strike. The members came down to the meeting hall today, heard a complete report. Every single one of them had a copy of the document, went through it in detail, and then they voted. Overwhelming proportion of the workforce came out and voted solidly to go on strike. 15 minutes after the word went out, the plant was emptying out on the second shift. Within minutes after that, picket lines were set up at, I think, at least a half dozen different gates around this very large complex. And people are out there. They're spirited. They're fighting. They're fighting for respect, which they just have not had for the last 4 years. They want to have a voice on the job. And they're going to get it back the way that it's been won by generations before them.
Yeah. No, I mean, no one wants to go on strike. Like, I've been on strike in the past. No one wants to do it. Sometimes you're pushed into it. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes it's the last arrow in the quiver, even though it sounds like this company wanted to take that arrow out of the quiver, which is why I think you have to fight to maintain that. Where do you see this going from here? I mean, are there planned negotiations in the coming, the next day or two? What do you see the next couple of days looking like?
Well, this literally has developed within the last couple hours. I don't think that there's been an opportunity for additional sessions to be scheduled. The company put out a what we frankly see as a silly statement tonight that they don't understand why we're on strike and why we aren't continuing to bargain. They are the ones who stopped bargaining 10 days ago, put a last, best, and final on the table. We've been trying to get it improved ever since. We've been trying to bargain every day since then. And we've had meetings with members of management where they said, yeah, we made some good points, and they would try and get some things improved. And everything's been shot down, apparently by corporate. That's where the decision makers are. And they decided that they wanted to, further shove it to people at the plant. I think it may be a miscalculation on their part. I don't know for sure. We'll find out. We're ready to go back to the table. We've already given them the list of things that they need to do to improve this and make it acceptable to the members. But frankly, at this point now that they've forced people out on strike, these things can get a life of their own. And folks have demands that are probably heavier than what was on the table at the last hour. And folks are going to be expecting a full plate of improvements rather than something that just kind of can patch things up for now. So we'll see. We're ready to go back to the table whenever the company is, but we're also ready to be out on the picket line for as long as it takes.
Now you got to stay one day longer. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Carl Rosen. Carl's the general president of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, UEUnion.org, the website, if you want to take a look at that. How can folks help? I mean, I know this is just developing. Is there some messaging? Can we start tweeting at WabTech? Can we start sending messages? What's the marching order for those of us who want to be helpful?
Sure. So UEUnion.org is a great place to go. There's a story up there. There's links there to our Facebook and Twitter feeds. You can Please share our social media messages around everybody you know in the story that we've got posted there and in various places. I think now we do have information. If there's folks who want to make a donation to the strike fund, you can certainly do that. And ways that you can send messages of solidarity. And if you're anywhere close to Erie, Pennsylvania, come on out to the picket lines 24/7. We're there. You know, it's on the border between Erie and Lawrence Park on the east side of Erie. You get anywhere near Erie, everybody knows where the Wabtec, the former GE locomotive plant, is at. You can't miss it. It's about 3/4 of a mile on a side, and gates on every side of it. You'll find us.
No, it's a big place. We were there in October, and having these conversations and hoping we wouldn't be here today. But one of the things that did come up was, you know, this transition to renewable, you know, locomotives to the next generation and wanting that production to be there. And especially with the talk of the Biden administration of, you know, green energy and domestic production, this seems like a perfect thing for this company really to step to the front and say, yeah, we're going to make this in America. We're going to use good paid workers. This seems like a good opportunity for them to take advantage of what the Biden administration is throwing out for them and maybe even get some money along the way.
It's an excellent opportunity for them, and they should take advantage of it, but they seem right now more interested in taking advantage of the fact that in large parts of the former industrial swaths of this country, there's a, you know, good number of people who don't have access to good jobs at good wages, and so they're trying to take $35-$40 an hour jobs and turn them into $20 an hour jobs. And, you know, that's what their 10-year progression does. And it's just, it's an outrage. It's unacceptable. And it's no way to build a community. It's no way to show support for the community of Erie that this plant has, always been in and ought to continue to be. And instead, you know, they do have a non-union operation in the South. They've got a global footprint. They're trying to take advantage of all of those places, too. And, yeah, but on the other hand, their best skills, their best facilities, all of it is right here in Erie. And, they're going to need to stay here, and they need to make sure that the workers are supported at a level that they can thereby support their families or community, et cetera.
So what's the last bit I want to give you? I want to give you 30 seconds to, you know, message to those members out on the picket line of UE Local 506 and 618. Carl Rosen, what do you got for them?
Look, this is one of the strongest group of rank and file workers anywhere in this country. When Wabtec came in and tried to impose terms on them 4 years ago, the workers walked out in a very disciplined way. They punched in with the new employer, and within hours after that, They were all on the street. It took 9 days, but it forced the company to yield and to put back what had been the former terms there, and then negotiate a new contract from there. They did it then. The workers can do it again now. It was incredible to see how they had these picket lines assembled, tents going up, everything, you know, within dozens of minutes of the strike vote being tabulated. These folks are ready to take care of business. They're doing it, and they appreciate everybody's solidarity, and they will help. I think this is the beginning of, you know, a number of industrial fights this summer. We've got UPS coming up. We've got the auto contracts coming up, and workers are ready to get their fair share again.
And I'm not surprised it's your members at UE Local 506 and 618 who are out there leading this. Some of the most militant folks I've met. I wish them the best. I wish you the best, Carl, and I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Rick, and you take care.
Thanks so much, Carl Rosen, General President of UE. UEUnion.org, the website. Check that out. If you can help chip in, by all means, that as well. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1977. The eyes of the British labor movement were turned to the Grunwick Film Labor Processing Laboratories in northwest London. Members of trade unions participated in a large demonstration at the factory. Miners from as far away as South Wales traveled to show their solidarity. As police tried to bring in buses of scabs, the picketers and the police clashed. The bloody scenes played on television sets across the country. The workers at the plant had been on strike since late summer of 1976. They were demanding the right of union recognition. The majority of the workers were women from Southern Asia. The company intentionally hired these women in an effort to keep wages low. One striker explained, "Imagine how humiliating it was for us, particularly for older women, to be working and to overhear the employer say to a younger English girl, 'You don't want to come and work here, love. We won't be able to pay you the sort of wages that'll keep you here,' while we had to work there because we were trapped." The strike had started when a man was fired for working too slowly. A small group of his co-workers walked off the job in protest. From there, the strike grew, catching the attention of the broader British labor movement. This strike marked an important turning point, as British trade unionists supported a predominantly South Asian workforce. Earlier strikes by South Asian workers had not received similar support. Despite this show of solidarity, the company remained entrenched, battling vehemently against the recognition of the union. The women at the plant fought for 2 years, until the strike was called off. The end of the protracted battle was seen as a major blow to labor. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, again, our friends out in UE Local 506 and 618. And again, we were out there in October, and this came up, the idea that there was potentially going to be a strike because, you know, again, they had a list of things that they needed. And I think Carl's right. It's going to be an interesting summer. Because corporate America is used to having their way. They're used to pushing people around. They're used to getting whatever they want. And finally, people are saying enough is enough and demanding more. I mean, it's about time. And it's one of those things that I remember back, 2009-10, me saying, when do we start, pushing back? Because wages have been suppressed for decades. The redistribution of wealth from workers to the investor class has just been continuing and ongoing, and the pandemic made it worse. You look at healthcare, you look at retirement security, you look at all of those things that American dream was built on. And there are still some people who hold on to this. Look, I guess I'm just a little bit older. My kids don't have the same view of what that future is going to be because they don't know what it could be because they don't ever remember seeing people have it. And these are folks in these jobs saying, look, we know that this used to be the job, that you got in this plant, you learned this skill, you worked your butt off, you did 40 years, got your gold watch, you supported a family, you led the American dream. And now these companies are like, no, everyone's disposable. There's no loyalty anymore. There's no dedication. There's no, and it's not from the employees. This is a corporate thing. The business schools have been teaching this for years. So when I see this happen, I go, look, I've been on strike and there's no fun in this. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants to have to not know if they're going to get a paycheck next week. No one wants to be in a situation where they have to tell the kids, sorry, we can't go to a ball game, or I can't get you new shoes because we don't have a paycheck. Nobody wants to have to go out and start scurrying for other sources of income to put food on the table. No one wants to do that. But sometimes the fight is right. Sometimes the fight is important.
In fact, I was just having this conversation with somebody the other day about the freight contract that's being voted on right now by the Teamsters. And they were saying, well, it's not enough money. It's, you know, it's not this, it's not that. And I said, well, you know, the reality is in 94 when we went on strike, then it was about saving full-time jobs. It was about ensuring that the people who work on the docks and load the trucks and unload the trucks and do all the hustling around and all of that, that those would be quality full-time employment jobs. Those were going to be career jobs. We weren't going to allow four-hour, you know, people to come in and work part-time and for less wages and less health care and less retirement. That wasn't going to happen. It was about maintaining that ability to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. And going into that, knowing that, you know, potentially economically we're gonna take a beating, but maintaining that security of that job for future generations was that important. Those are the things that you strike over. It's the principled stuff. Yeah, wages, hours, conditions. Yeah, but as Carl pointed out, you know, commitments that you're gonna use this plant into the future to for the next line. That's important too. Especially as we move to a greener economy. Making those green locomotives in Erie would be a good thing for that community. So I'm going to be interested to see where this takes us. And really, how long this takes. I hope it's not long, like every strike. You hope it's short. You hope it's overwhelming. You hope that the splash is big. It gets the attention. Because strikes are really about jump-starting negotiations. It's really about going, it's a shock to the system. And it's about getting back to the table because ultimately you've got to come to an agreement. Ultimately that has to happen. So my thoughts are with the folks there out in Erie. And again, if you want to help out, ueunion.org. If you want to check out the work that they're doing. There are 1,400 members tonight who are walking the picket lines there in Erie. And good on them. I do want to go back real quick because we brought it up earlier with Morris Pearl that the Republican Study Committee, again, is pushing these changes to Social Security and Medicare. Now, remember, as we've talked about before, Republicans said they weren't in favor of, you know, us? We would never cut Social Security. No, we would never cut Medicare. No, we would never. No, not us. Not us. No, we wouldn't do that. Trust us. Checks in the mail. Back at it again. And you've got 176 members of this Republican Study Committee who have signed on to this stuff. So this isn't just the handful of the fringe. This isn't just the kook caucus. This just isn't the hey, look at me people. This is the Republican establishment. And if you're a working person right now and you're in your 40s and 50s and you're thinking that there might be retirement down the road, they're talking about raising the Social Security eligibility age to up to 69 from 67. Had been 65. Did you see what they did in France when they raised it from 62 to 64? Maybe we should start talking about this. And again, I bring up the strike, the UE strike as direct worker action. The idea of worker power. You don't need to be in a union to have worker power. You don't need to be in a union to stand with your coworkers and your fellow citizens to demand better from your government or from corporations or from your community. You don't need to be a card-carrying member. But you do need to understand that we've all got common interests. And that the quicker we come back together, the quicker we take off the red hats and the blue hats, the quicker we move on the issues, as Morris pointed out, it's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's not about red, blue, as Rupert Murdoch said. It really is about the green. It's about the money. And the sooner we wake up to that reality and put all the other stuff aside, all of the rainbow flags and all of the stuff that they keep distracting us with, the sooner we do that, I think the better off we're going to be. And then we can solve all those other problems. But a lot of the anger and the frustration, I still come back to. I think people are struggling to make ends meet. They're having a hard time. and they're given something to be angry about. How about we give people something to be positive about? Creating jobs that are going to be able to support a family, rebuilding stuff that's going to make it easier for us to get around and maintain our daily lives. How about that? A government of, for, and by.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.